study with Ken Chu in the in fisheries. And he's been involved with Puget Sound Water Quality for a long time and joined the Puget Sound Water Quality Authority in 1991. He's involved with the Puget Sound Action Team and the Puget Sound Partnership, and today he's going to tell us about Hood Canal, lessons learned, and charting a corrective course of action.
I remember, really, it's 40 years ago that I was here at the U, or 42 or something, and I remember sitting in class and certainly learning a lot from professors, and sometimes at a level that I couldn't understand, and I look forward to somebody coming in to explain real practical application, and as Bob said, the main reason I transferred out of biological oceanography into fisheries was because I was much more practically oriented. I really wanted to try and grow shellfish or fish, and I liked the science part of it, but it somehow had to be, to really catch my interest, I wanted it to be applied rather than theoretical. And now I find myself in this really kind of interesting spot to try and bridge the gap a little bit. I'm still very interested in the science, but I realize much of what we do scientifically has to form the basis of good policy, and it needs to be the underpinning of decisions we make. But the politics of how you get to solutions is at least half the battle, probably more like three-quarters of the battle. And I've had the pleasure in working in Hood Canal with working with a few people in the room today, so I'm also glad to have them as resources to answer more technical questions that might come from you. So it's a pleasure to be here. I think probably a little bit more of my background. I've worked in pollution chemistry in the pulp and paper industry. And again, that was really applied to what do you do in chemical processes in pulp mills that improves water quality. And now I've been working for almost 20 years in public service with the agency and fully realized that working with local governments, tribal governments, all levels of federal and state and local governments is really where there has to be better coordination, there has to be better information that's translated from, again, from the scientific basis, but into the practical application. What is doable politically, and what are the citizens that live on Hood Canal or live in South Sound or in Seattle, what are you willing to pay for? That's a lot of what it comes down to, whether it's stormwater or sewage treatment, low-impact development. We have a lot of great ideas that come based on good science, and we can show real differences in what we can do. But where it translates, and we're in an interesting political climate now, economic climate nationally and at the state level and at the local level, what can we afford? And what are the trade-offs between jobs and the environment, which often gets to be kind of tricky? I'm really happy to be involved in Hood Canal, partly because I've grown up around the canal in South Puget Sound all my life, so 60 years of watching change that's taken place along the canal. There's always been a string of houses along the canal, a lot of them sort of cabins that have been transformed into much bigger houses now. But the reality is Hood Canal has grown sort of commensurate with the way the rest of Puget Sound and the Northwest has changed. What used to be summertime homes have now transferred to being full occupancy, or certainly in summertime there's a lot more use. So we're faced with this challenge, not only currently looking backward, but currently looking forward in how growth will affect Hood Canal. And are we on this tipping point between sort of natural conditions assimilating some of the nutrients that we put in, but as we grow and more nutrients, especially at some times of the year, will kind of tip that balance. And I think that's one of the challenging things we're faced with. I work with the Hood Canal Dissolved Oxygen Program, which really the integrated assessment and modeling part of HCDOP, we call it, is centered here at the university. I think you've had Jan Newton at the Applied Physics Lab has talked to you, at least to this class before, I'm not sure of the same students. But Jan really has led the way in the scientific part of it. Jeff Ritchie has been very helpful in the terrestrial modeling side of things. We have people in the civil and environmental engineering department, Mike Brett's here, and Julie too, who have done a lot of the work in understanding how nitrogen travels through sort of what the fate and effects of nitrogen through a home septic system, what happens to that, how does it get into fresh water and then marine water, or more directly into marine water, and how that changes over the year. So working with HCDOP, and then my biggest capacity has been in trying to translate what that scientific information does in terms of corrective actions and education that will change people's behavior. And as I say, even though I'm very interested in science, I realized how we make that handoff, how we use the good scientific information as the basis for good policy decisions and economic decisions and what we're going to do, the two have to work hand in hand. And this umbrella of HCDOP has been a really great way of doing that. We have, I think our website, the website centered here at the university, says 38 organizations that can be state, federal, tribal, citizen groups. It's quite a wide array, and you can get on the website and see how that lines up, and I would encourage you to do that. We're now, Jan Newton and Dan Hanifus with the Salmon Enhancement Group, Hood Canal Salmon Enhancement Group, Jeff Ritchie, USGS folks have helped to put together, and it was actually highlighted in a science symposium that was held in Bremerton in June, the end of June of this year. And that was really at the request of Congressman Norm Dix. Norm has been very, very helpful in getting funding for this integrated assessment and modeling, the scientific modeling side of what we're trying to understand better, how Hood Canal works, both the terrestrial side and the marine side of Hood Canal. And he wanted a display of where are we in this modeling study, what are some of the major conclusions that we've come to. And I think I'll show those in just a minute. But I'd like a show of hands just to see, did anybody attend that science symposium? So we have a couple, three maybe, and some who were presenters at that symposium. We're at this interesting intersection right now of using that good scientific basis and doing some additional modeling runs and verifying the models. That will still be ongoing for another year. But we're at this very interesting point of handing off the findings of that and translating that into what can be done in terms of regulations or voluntary programs to work on such things as septic systems or on-site systems in people's own backyards or front yards. What do we do with alder trees? And we'll get to that in a few minutes. And I'm really glad to meet Bob Edmonds, because his name has been raised as one of those important resources that can help us understand what does it mean when we hear about alders being implicated in nitrogen that enters the canal and blooms plankton, and as it dies and sinks to the bottom and decomposes, that's what uses oxygen. So we're kind of working on this principle of reducing the amount of nitrogen that is human-related or land conversion-related, and what can we do in that politically and economically. And one reason it's exciting to be here is because I realize looking at you, it's like looking back for some of us 40 or 50 years and realizing we were sitting there, and right now you're the people that will move into those positions to translate what you've learned at the university, but work in public affairs and work in fisheries and work in oceanography and work in forestry. So it's really, I hope, something that will intrigue you to think that there's a good natural transition that you can be making in your lives to be a part of the solutions that lie ahead for us. This, and I apologize, I am not a technical person. Last night I sat down and
and sort of put a few slides together just in the most basic of PowerPoint, which is all I can do. And this is a slide that just shows some, this highlights a couple of the major results that Jan Newton shared at that science symposium in June, and realizing that the main influencer of Hood Canal's condition in terms of dissolved oxygen, and I'm going to talk about all of Hood Canal, and I'm sorry I don't have a slide. Hopefully most of you are familiar with Hood Canal. You think of it as a big L-shaped body of water, with the north end of it being up near Port Townsend, and it comes down in a great L, and right at the what I'll call the Great Bend, where it turns from north to south and goes east-west, and it ends at the headwaters, if you think of it that way, or at the dead end at Belfair. Those two systems, what I'll call the main stem, which is north-south, and then the east-west leg of this, which we'll call Lower Hood Canal, are certainly connected bodies of water, but they operate quite differently. And the modeling will yield results that are different in our implications of what we do, not for all of Hood Canal in terms of on-sites, because if nutrients get in, they can move plankton anywhere. But that Lower Hood Canal being at the more constricted end, shallower end, is slower in circulating, getting replacement water to it, and nutrient, it seems to be a more sensitive system than the main stem. But in terms of all of Hood Canal, it's safe to say that natural factors play a huge role in how this oxygen and nutrient cycle works. That in fact, seasonally from year to year, how much sunlight we get at certain times of the year, and it can start early in the year. It can start in February, where we get those long, cold, but good intensity, relative high intensity of sunlight in the wintertime, starts plankton blooms in that early part of the year. And if you then stay with a fairly moderate and warm springtime, and a fair amount of fresh water that can flow in and stratify the canal, that sets up a condition that results in the fall in an upwelling condition that can be very stressful or even lethal to fish. And quite honestly, that's what gets people's attention. It's not just the interesting change in dissolved oxygen. It's when we get fish kills or we don't get crabs repopulating in Lower Hood Canal, which is the case right now. That's what grabs the public's attention and makes them think, man, we've got a real dangerous situation. We need to do something about it as a society. And that's the reality. And then ocean condition, with much of when fresh water flows out from south to north in the canal, with the five major rivers that flow into the canal, Skokomish River being at that Great Bend area, that's the main driver of circulation at the surface. The replacement water that comes in from the north end and comes in deep is often very high in nutrients and relatively low in oxygen. And that sort of conveyor belt will force the older water in the canal to the surface, and that's often what will result in these fish kills if we get this perfect storm of conditions of sunlight, wind out of the southwest that blows the surface water north, and the replacement water then sort of works as upwelling to the surface, and that is what will force the more mobile fish life, but that still can't get out of the way and results in their death. And you can imagine a lot of the invertebrates and non-mobile species that are on the bottom really takes its toll on those. Let's see here. I'll hit the forward button. So it's in Lower Hood Canal, again, thinking of this Great Bend area from the east-west arm in the lower part of the canal that's shallower. The modelers have concluded that human factors, meaning on-site septic systems, conversion of land, stormwater runoff, can affect the dissolved oxygen by as much as a milligram per liter. And if you think of surface water, a milligram per liter in well-saturated water where you have maybe 8 or 10 parts per million, that's not a big deal, but we're talking about the the deeper water that is, and especially the water that's down fairly close to the bottom, if that goes from 2 milligrams per liter down to 1 milligram per liter, that's often enough to wipe out resources such as crabs that can't live long-term in that low-oxygen water. We're still learning more and more about the biota of the canal, but just think of it from, and it's not the same from year to year. That's one of the challenges we have. When we have better conditions, stronger winds, better flushing of the canal, lower solar periods, we'll get conditions like this year, interestingly enough, where dissolved oxygen, even in the bottom water, is much better than it's been. Consistent with what we saw in the 50s. So this is a changeable thing that changes with natural factors, but it does change with what we do as human beings as well because of this tipping point idea. Again, mild, sunny winter conditions and continuing into the spring and summer do affect this condition in Lower Hood Canal to a greater extent. We know that a marine water body like Hood Canal, being this fjord-like body of water, is nitrogen limited. So if we add more nitrogen, especially in the high solar conditions of spring and summer, we will get much more plankton growth. And it's not just at the surface. A lot of people will look out and see a plankton bloom just on the surface. What Janet has demonstrated to me, often these real big blooms are down 10 meters. It's often where the highest nitrogen water right at the haline, the change from saltier to fresher as you go up, that is that interface between high nutrient water and where you get enough light penetration, blooms plankton like crazy at that level. And again, it helps surface oxygenation, but it hurts as it dies off and sinks to the bottom and decomposes. And then there is this natural cycle a couple of times a year where replacement water that comes in at depth from the north end of the canal to the south, that is very high nitrate water. But often the modelers have demonstrated that a lot of that water doesn't, and now I'm talking about the main stem, the north to south arm of the canal, a lot of that water comes clear to the Great Bend area, but it comes back up and circulates back out below the what's the term? Mike, help me with the term.
Euphotic zone.
The euphotic zone. Thank you. And so, if it doesn't trigger or it doesn't stimulate the plankton bloom, it's not as big a problem as we thought. So, again, in places where we get a lot of fresh water runoff. At the surface where plankton will grow better, the nutrients coming in at the surface, whether it's a wastewater system or nutrients from fertilizers on your lawn, will grow plankton much more in that surface than will be affected at depth.
Let me see. I can get more efficient about this. Again, a couple of the major conclusions that we've reached are that septic systems, in terms of what anthropogenic or human-related sources are, septics play an important role. And more recently, we've found that alder trees that can be, you know, the first successional forests, especially on small areas of land or converted areas, some of the timber companies, for instance, I understand, will encourage alders to grow in some areas just to put nitrogen back into the soil so they can then grow coniferous forests. And this is where I really want to have the conversation with Bob and have him be involved in a task force of DNR people, forestry people at private forest companies like Simpson or Mankey, who are worried about the implication if we're talking about alder trees being a quote bad thing for Hood Canal. What does it really mean, and what are the implications for forestry practices? Is it really a problem as big as the models will show? Is it more of a timing thing where we might get nutrients from
from alder trees coming into the watershed in the fall and winter with heavy runoff where we don't have a lot of light. So they may not be blooming plankton, even if the nitrate is coming in from that source. Those are the kinds of things that I think academic institutions and people that are very knowledgeable about this need to start weighing in what our messaging is and what are the implications for forestry management. And then that I've already talked about the second part of the release of nitrogen. In terms of nitrogen, Mike Brett and Julie are important in demonstrating from what they've looked at in the soils around septic systems. We always think, and this has been my assumption, that in the summertime we have a lot more residential use and a lot more visitors in Lower Hood Canal for water skiing and just recreating there. So we sort of overtax our septic systems during that time period. And some of those homes that are right adjacent to salt water, they basically have a bulkhead, soils that often have their drain field and their septic tank right in that small patch of lawn, and then their house, and then the road. They really don't have alternatives or easy alternatives for dissipating their effluent further away from the canal or further from groundwater. So we've realized those are high-risk areas, and we need to do something about that. But Mike has demonstrated that some of the nitrates that come out of our septic systems, in fact, are sequestered. They don't really get flushed into the canal until more in the fall when we get heavy rains that saturate soils and carry that into fresh water or more directly into marine water. So these are sort of the fine-tuning realities that we have to do in the modeling right now, and that's why a lot of the work that's done in different disciplines here at the university, not only applied physics lab, fisheries, oceanography, forestry, but the civil and environmental engineering, this interdisciplinary approach is really critical to sort of testing our theories and making sure that we're giving correct information.
A few things that we've done, we've decided we're not just going to wait for the results, and this was an assumption 4 years ago, we're not just going to wait for the results of the modeling, the terrestrial and marine modeling, we're going to start doing things. That's another message to you as students, that we can't have the luxury of waiting for all the scientific information to come in. Many politicians and many citizens want to be doing things right away that are going to be helpful. Maybe it's not exactly the exact order of emphasis, but let's start doing something that will help correct the problem. So right away, we started working with the Skokomish tribes that has a major fishery for chum salmon, but all species, but especially fall chum salmon, that come back to the south end of the canal, to the Hoodsport Hatchery and the Skokomish River. And a common practice especially for periods of time that chum salmon weren't very valuable market-wise, the tribal fishermen who were mostly gill netting or beach seining those fish would take the excess fish that weren't going to market or weren't valuable for eggs and disposing of those carcasses in deep water. Well, we quite quickly realized with 300,000 fish coming back in many years to Southwood Canal, if we disposed of those carcasses in deep marine water, there's high biochemical oxygen demand, a lot of protein and nitrogen associated with those and carbon associated with those that could be adding to the problem. So right away, we contracted with the tribe to change their practices. Much of that excess fish either turned into good compost and then fertilizers that were used by the Department of Transportation as an example, or tribal elders for their family gardens. We then have started working and continue working on human sewage as being one of the major sources of nitrogen and fecal coliform bacteria. So we said, let's try and tighten up our septic regulations and do a better job of monitoring on-site septic systems, identifying the high-risk ones and fixing them, develop a
procedure so people could get low interest loans for that. All of that is some, you know, kind of in the policy arena, but we've made good progress there. And we've started working on the design and ultimately construction of advanced wastewater systems, including, and I'll get to that in just a minute, but especially in Lower Hood Canal, where we know the sort of the major part of the problem of persistent low oxygen and added nutrients exacerbating that problem. We have four major systems, or five if you count state parks, with advanced wastewater systems that will incorporate membrane bioreactor technology and reduce the nutrient, the nitrogen from human waste to a very, very low level, you know, cut it by 50% at least, if not more. We've worked on stormwater controls and passing ordinances at the local level and encouraging low-impact development. So we're building, in fact, requiring construction to incorporate low-impact development in this sensitive part of Hood Canal. And then the big part of this is educating real people, because most people we found really do want to do the right thing. They want to have their own septic system working right. They want to apply fertilizers that are slow release and that are not adding to the problem. So working, and again, the University of Washington, and especially Sea Grant program, people like Terry King play a very important role, as does WSU Extension, in coordinating some of the educational messages and ways that we deliver messages to people, working through the Hood Canal Watershed Education Network. And then we've looked at some things. There's a biosolids application site in what's called Webb Hill above Union, Washington, right at the Great Bend, that was applying biosolids to a patch of land that grew grasses. They were applying at agronomic rates that could be taken up by the grass, and then cattle were eating the grass. But we found that there are certain concerns with groundwater. We've invested in groundwater wells to monitor and see if groundwater is picking this up, and also what surface water runoff is doing. So we're trying to tighten up just by management. And the biosolids company has been very cooperative in saying, we want to do the right thing. They've cut their application rate in half, and they'll do more if need be. But counterbalance that with, we're also going to be generating more biosolids with these advanced wastewater systems. So we need to figure out, you know, write that down. We need to figure out better ways to deal with biosolids. And there are some engineering solutions to that, but we can't apply more to the land, so how do we treat the biosolids? And then we're working with ag waste. There is a fair amount of commercial and non-commercial agriculture, especially in the Skokomish River Valley. And we're working on with the Mesa Conservation District, working on an anaerobic digester to deal with that waste stream.
Let's see. Already, I've forgotten. There we go. Some of this I've already talked about, so my goal is to try and get done so we can have an interchange and you can ask questions, and if I can't answer them, I'll turn to the brains in the room. We've worked with different kinds of nitrogen-reducing technologies, some commercial on-site systems, either add-on systems to retrofit existing on-site systems, or new systems that have been put in the ground. We've had demonstrations with six different technologies, and we have a technical report on this if you're interested. What we've concluded is those systems work reasonably well at reducing nitrogen, and the emphasis here is if they're maintained properly. If they're not maintained, and we found most of them needed some tweaking from month to month when they were monitored, if they're not maintained, they go back to being probably less effective than just a normal gravity system. I've talked about Mike Brett, Mark Benjamin, their good work in monitoring studies, and we hope we can continue some of those monitoring wells that are in place because they're yielding some very important information right now. We're working with this advanced wastewater facilities
using membrane bioreactor technology to remove the nitrogen or to minimize the amount of nitrogen coming from the waste in state park facilities, both at Potlatch, Dosing Wallach State Park, which is on the west side of the canal, about halfway up the main stem, and then in the sensitive areas of Lower Hood Canal, and what we're in this area called Hood's Kapot. It really means Hood's Port, Skokomish Reservation, and Potlatch, including a little community called Minerva Beach, which is also where tribal housing is putting in about 90 new homes to get tribal housing out of the floodplain, which is where it currently exists in the Skokomish Reservation area. So all of these things are really going to help in terms of nutrients, but also pathogens, you know, fecal bacteria, that fecal coliform bacteria that get in the water and downgrade shellfish growing areas at the mouth of the Skokomish River, for instance. And it's a very high priority for the tribe. And then again, stormwater and low impact development, especially targeted in Hood's Port, Belfair, and then in a little community that's actually not in technically in Hood Canal, it's in North Bay, just across the sort of the peninsula from Belfair over in South Sound, but in Allen, which has also a very sensitive water body and a real fecal coliform problem. So those are some sort of policy generated ideas that come out of the Hood Canal work that will be multiply beneficial.
Now I see this thing fell off probably a long time ago. So, and what we've learned, again, I've talked about the high
the on-site systems that employ sophisticated technology. They can work, but they really have to be maintained well. There need to be good alternatives to conventional on-site systems, and I'd be the first to admit, you know, we're trying to communicate with people about doing the best they can, and right now we don't have tried and true and adopted by State Department of Health systems that we can point to say these are really good at reducing nitrogen from on-site systems. So we're really in the middle of developing technology that will, at a home scale, deal with removing nitrogen from on-site systems. We're working on developing on-site utilities. Think of it as kind of either a stormwater utility, but for your septic system, or even a water system that is employed using utility concepts. We need to do the same thing with conventional on-site systems. And many people don't like regulatory agencies coming in and checking their system and looking over their shoulder. They're much more amenable to having a private company come in and work with them. So this is a concept that's really beginning to take shape right now. And then developing community systems that may service 20 or say 15 to 30 homes that might be in a cluster and would have access to a good plot of land where you could put a good community grain field and have shallow rooted plants that could uptake nitrogen from that and convert it into nitrogen gas rather than having to go into water. We have one good demonstration of that concept at Madrona Beach, which is near Union, but we need to work more and more on those. It's not a full-blown like we're intending to have in Belfair or Hood's Port or Skokomish or Potlatch, but we have many areas where we can get better dissipation of effluent than we're currently doing. We're also, I think I explained, we're in position to have MBR technology in place and working, but that's not going to take shape and actually be in the ground until 2010. We're going to probably have Belfair first, I would say Potlatch State Park and the Potlatch Minerva Beach area and tribal area up and running next, and it may be Dosey Wallops, the state park at Dosey would be next. We have to have systems in place so we can measure and demonstrate their utility and their real benefit to water quality. And we need to have efficiency of scale. If we get a number of these systems working together in the same general area, we can have one or two operators servicing a whole bunch of systems, which is a whale a lot more efficient in terms of money. And then there's room for new ideas. I put that down kind of as a trigger to say we need to, even in septic technology, there's real room for technology improvement. My eyes were opened by one of our State Department of Health members that plays a role in HCVOP, John Elliotson, who started out his discussion by saying in Europe, and especially in Scandinavian countries, this will sound kind of weird, but get used to it. He says they separate their toilet. So you have yellow water going one way and you have brown water going the other way. And the benefit is urine from our body contains something like 80% of the nitrogen that's the problem in the canal. In some of these Scandinavian and Germanic countries, they've separated the waste stream and they deal with the waste in its most concentrated form that can then be used as a benefit. They actually use it for fertilizer purposes with the urea and the urine, and it's viewed now as a beneficial byproduct and not as a waste stream that gets diluted in the drain field and becomes a problem. So it would require a heck of a lot of attitude change, probably in the way we're normally used to flushing toilets, but composting toilets and this bifurcated toilet, I think, have potential, especially if you put in perspective with people that they can either pay a sewer bill that's going to be $100 a month, or they can be, especially in areas that won't be sewered, if they put in one of these types of toilets that require a change in use, but will subsidize their toilet, maybe put it in free, and they don't have to pay anything for it. You know, I think the economics are going to come to play a big role here in what people are willing to do. And attitude changes can often be changed if it means a benefit to your pocketbook. So I think I'm going to stop there and encourage questions. I think we have 10 minutes left or so. Is that? So I encourage you to ask questions. And I'm quite sure I won't be able to answer them, but there are people who here who can help answer them. Yes, ma'am.
I was so you started out your talk talking about how decisions are made more from politics versus science. I was curious if you had any advice for us as the people in school now, how can we prepare ourselves for that kind of life and career?
Well, I think, you know, I have daughters probably your age, and I say even if you... even if you take a job, internships are certainly one great way to do that. And there are lots of opportunities with agencies and probably local governments to intern. I'm associated with the Northwest Straits Commission. We've had interns who have worked with us, with the Marine Resource Committees in the Northwest Straits. I think more of them have come out of maybe the Sea Grant program just because that's how we're connected to that. But I think those internships, but I've told my daughters, even if you take a job that you don't get paid for, you're a volunteer, but you get in and you show that you're really interested and you can sort of share your enthusiasm, it usually results in a job. And then once you're in a job, I think more for you than when I was in your seats. I mean, when I graduated from college, I remember taking my first job in the pulp and paper research facility in Shelton. And when I went around and talked to the old-timers, they said, not really enthused about what I'm doing, but, you know, they've never laid anybody off. And I think your generation is much more of the mind, I'm going to be enthusiastic about a job I take, but it's going to springboard into other opportunities. So I think getting that first significant job, even if it's a volunteer job, will pay dividends in moving in different avenues. We're always looking... You know, there's going to be a big turnover in state agencies in the next 5 to 10 years where people are retiring. My age, people are going to retire, you know, maybe do other things like consult or I'm going to raise shellfish. But I think there's a great opportunity for young, imaginative, bright people to move into, you know, you're not going to start as managers, but you can move into a job that may be much more field-oriented, that's a very good transitional point as you move up in your career. I thought I'd always be happy as kind of a hip boot biologist, but the reality is, as you get older and maybe you're not quite as good as getting out and doing the field work and you're raising a family, you realize the higher paying jobs are where you want to go. So there's a normal transition in a person's working career. Yes, ma'am.
I'm a shellfish biologist, I guess, in some regards. And I'm curious about two things. One is, for shellfish growers on the canal, do you think that in the future there's a possibility? So I know several shellfish growers have been frustrated by closures that have happened, you know, due to
her question was, are there opportunities? She's interested in shellfish culture, and she has friends who are on Hood Canal raising shellfish and realizing there's sometimes, and there are a number of reasons that shellfish are closed in the canal. Some of it related to what we talked about in terms of fecal pollution, but also harmful algal blooms and PSP blooms, especially in the north end of the canal, and also Vibrio parahemolyticus, which is associated with bottom sediments. I think there's a great opportunity, especially in Hood Canal, for shellfish culture as natural filters that take the plankton that result from the nutrification of the canal, and then you harvest the shellfish and you take them out of the system. That's something that many policy people don't understand. You don't get the real benefit of filtration until you take them out of the system. Just to have natural filters there is good, but they also respire and use oxygen, and so you need that two-phase, you know, the growing and natural filtration, but they remove them. And I've been, right from the beginning, one of the things that I, working with the shellfish industry that I'm fairly closely associated with, because that's what I've done all my life, and the Pacific Shellfish Institute, which I'm a board member of, trying to get the shellfish industry and working with the Skokomish Nation to put mussel rafts, for instance, being great three-dimensional natural filters, harvesting those, especially in the Great Bend area. I think there's real potential there. And harvesting more of the oysters, I think I'm sure you realize that Pacific oysters have become naturalized on the canal. Often, we used to use Hood Canal oysters as a seed source for a lot of the rest of Puget Sound. Now with hatchery development and technology, we don't use Hood Canal that way anymore. And so finding out a way to market more shellfish from Hood Canal will be a benefit. That's another thing that I think needs to be factored into the model and thinking about how shellfish in this positive aspect could be used as natural filters in addition to the technology we're talking about. I hope that helps. Yes, sir.
Just falling back on the model, now we know how the system works. We have flushing, we have flowing, pouring nutrients in from the upper Hood Canal into the lower. Are there any plans to put current meters or some type of physical monitoring system there so we can actually get real-time data? We know when the nutrients were flushing down the Hood Canal there to would fall in with the whole harvesting shellfish at the right time before red tides.
You know, I may not be the best person to answer that. I mean, the question related to real-time monitoring, and in fact, part of your question related to, can there be real-time monitoring to better understand when these upwelling events occur and water quality? That is a hallmark of what the IAM program, the Integrated Assessment and Modeling work, has done. There are four, the orca buoys that monitor real-time data. It's available on this website, the Hood Canal. Can you help me, Mike, with the actual website?
Well, all you need to do is put in ACBOP, Google that up, we'll take you right to that website.
Okay.
You know the address, but if you put ACBOP, that's the first place.
So you have buoys out there, right?
Yeah, there are buoys out there, and Algaball at Oceanography, and I forget some of the other researchers that have different kinds of current meters. That's part of what's been factored into the model. But kind of the follow-on to your question, long-term, we're trying to develop a continuing monitoring program. We can't probably afford to keep all four buoys operating and do the intensive work that the Hood Canal Salmon Enhancement Group has done with citizen groups to monitor marine water at something like 10 stations every week, which has been really good monitoring data, but we can't keep that up. So we need to think of scaling back, and that's where Jan needs to lead the way, really, in saying, what is a scaled-back version of a marine monitoring, and I think terrestrial monitoring program that can keep tabs on and sort of validate the model as time goes on. That's kind of what we're coming into. We have one more year on federal funding for the integrated assessment and modeling work, and beyond that, so this year we need to plan for what is going to step in to take that place in the future. Yes, ma'am.
Can you comment at all about the recent push of shellfish growers wanting to increase data production in the canals, the politics surrounding that?
Okay, the question relates to Guida culture and especially in, I think, as applies to Hood Canal. You know, I'm going to sidestep that a little bit because I know in just a couple of weeks, Debbie, Glenn Van Larrickham, who I know quite well because we both went to high school together, he's here at the U and will be talking specifically about GUI docs and the sort of the monitoring that is in place through funding that went to Sea Grant. Some of it Glenn has received to do good research about the real implications of culture and harvest of GUI ducks. What we found in some of the monitoring work is the, especially the lower part of Hood Canal has not had a natural set of GUI ducks for a long time. And there was a set maybe 15 years ago that seems to have disappeared. The presumption being that this persistent low oxygen condition has wiped out that stock. So that's subtitle. What most of the culture now is intertidal. So that would be a great question and really lay it to Glenn when he's in. Yes, sir.
You mentioned that only dead fish are correct the topic of attention. So, but those, they're not always biological response for to those process-based actions. So how do you deal with that gap? Do you have special, certain species-focused actions or?
Okay, the question relates to, the point I was trying to make was what catches public's attention is if you, you know, a lot of citizens in Lower Canal are really tweaked that they can't go out and catch crab anymore. When they put their pots down, they pull the pot up, there are no crabs, and it's just full of very nasty hydrogen sulfide-y sort of mud, and there's apparently no marine life there. The same thing when we get these episodic fish kills in the Sun Rock area, say Potlatch, north of Hoodsport area, that we've had in 2003 and 2006, most extremely. That's what divers and the public, just thinking about if you read in the paper, if the PI paper picks up a story, they're often showing pictures, and we've got good, on the ACDOP website, we have a good film of what's happened to lingcod and rockfish in some of these areas. That really grabs the public attention to say, oh man, this is serious and we've got to do something about it. So right now, I mean, I think there has to be more species-specific work done, research done on those species to see, you know, is it a critical life stage for reproduction of some of these species that get wiped out in real sensitive form? Can some things be supplemented? Is it just a natural cycle? We had a very good presentation by some university researchers here on crabs saying they're very cyclic, and it may be on a 10-year cice. We might just be at a low ebb. So that's part of the messaging, that we've got to be honest to it. But the point I tried to make was what grabs the bigger public attention is often one of these catastrophic kind of events.
Good. Thanks very much.